Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Christina Hellman and I represent the petitioner Chris Martin. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. For many people, guns are scary. For all of us, domestic violence assaults are scary. But placing guns and domestic violence assaults together is terrifying. Mr. Martin's trial placed these two elements together solely because his counsel failed to file a meritorious motion to sever the felon in possession of firearm charges. The motion to sever would have been reversible error to deny under Oregon law. It was meritorious. Mr. Martin has thus established performance problems under Strickland. To prove prejudice, he must only demonstrate a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And the briefs discuss several ways in which he was prejudiced. But this morning I'd like to focus on the way in which the felon in possession charges prejudiced the trial as a whole. This trial was all about intent and credibility. Who was the jury going to believe, Mr. Martin or Ms. Comer? When the jury was evaluating this, what they knew is that Mr. Martin was a felon. He was a bad guy. And they knew that there were guns. There were guns stashed in the truck, and there were guns stashed in the house. However, the guns had nothing to do with the assault charges. The trial court recognized that specifically at sentencing. When the jury is weighing and balancing the evidence in this case, the balance was off because of counsel's failure. That was prejudicial to Mr. Martin.
Didn't the jury acquit Mr. Martin of some of the charges, even in the face of overwhelming evidence, which might suggest that Martin was actually not prejudiced by the failure to sever the charges?
Yes, Your Honor. The jury acquitted him on two charges, an assault one and interfering with a report. The assault one acquittal, though, likely, as the district attorney recognized, came from failure of some sort in the charge. At the conclusion of the case, the district attorney himself said that he believed that was a close call, even from grand jury. So the mere fact of an acquittal on that charge does not mean that he was not prejudiced. Again, also, when they're thinking about the rest of the charges, prejudice is not an all-or-nothing thing. It's not necessarily only that they just decide he's bad and will convict on everything. But when they're thinking about whether they're going to believe him or believe her, they've tipped the balance against believing him because of what was also included. If you think about it in this way, if they had gone into his home when they were looking for her and then searching for him, and the walls had been plastered with awards and signs that talked about what a great guy he was and how he had contributed so much to the community and he was, this upstanding citizen, the jury would view his testimony in a different light. And instead, what they viewed it through was a lens that did not exist in the case. And so, yes, the acquittal may at first seem as though there was no prejudice. But if you look at it the other way, it also shows that the entire case against Mr. Martin was not necessarily a slam dunk, that the jury was not just routinely deciding to convict him, but they were also doing their job. But while they were doing their job, they were looking at it in a false way.
The prior convictions could not have come in anyway in the trial. He did testify, right?
Yes, he did, Your Honor.
Would the prior convictions have come in?
No, Your Honor. He would have had a good reason to not have them come in. Oregon Evidence Code 609 governs the admissibility of charges to impeach, and it is true that convictions for which a person can be imprisoned for more than a year can come in. However, subsection 3 of that evidence rule says that if the charges are more than 15 years old, they are not available for impeachment. So under the same argument as I made in the briefs, why the charges should not have been brought at all, Mr. Martin would have had a reason to be able to testify, but not have the jury know that he was a felon.
But there were other violent prior acts that could have come in with regard to his acts, as I understand it, with regard to this particular victim.
His prior
domestic violence
against her. Your Honor, I believe that may be true, but I haven't looked directly at it. I believe that the same Oregon evidence rule may have allowed some of that to come in. But I don't believe that those were felony charges.
Did they involve guns?
No. I don't believe so, Your Honor.
You know, as I was reading this, I was trying to figure out why the counsel was reluctant to argue the staleness of the prior felony conviction. I really question whether it was actually waived because the fact that his counsel might have known a lot more and had good reasons for not raising it because of Mr. Martin's prior records. Do you have any comment? Is there anything in the record to give us any insight on this?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record to give us insight as to what you're asking, whether counsel knew something additional. What we have in the record is trial counsel's affidavit in which he explains his reason for not filing this motion. And he says, this is at supplemental excerpt of record, page 18, I did not move to sever. When the police responded to the victim's 911 call, one gun was found in petitioner's truck and two were found in the home petitioner shared with victim. That's trial counsel's entire explanation on the, why he did not move to sever. Doesn't give any reason why he believed that there were additional problems with filing a motion to sever, nor does he actually accurately assess the situation. The fact that the guns were found only after the assault was alleged to have been completed means that the charges were not properly joined under Oregon law at all. So that's what we have in the record to evaluate counsel's decision.
So ultimately the case comes down to a prejudice question.
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
And it's a prejudice based on IAC prejudice, i.e. reasonable probability that the result would have been different?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what would you tell us about that? The trial judge here was very emphatic about the fact that he found the that he was quite sure it would have been the same anyway.
Your Honor, when you say the trial judge, do you mean the district court in this case or the state court
district
trial
court.
Judge? That's correct. The district court believed that the case would have come out, there would have been no reasonable probability of a different outcome. But the district court was incorrect in making that determination because he focused first on the acquittal, which, as I've explained, does not necessarily mean that there was no prejudice. And second, he focused on the fact that Ms. Comer's testimony was strong, as he characterized it, and also supported by the medical evidence. And so in response, I have 2 points to make on that. First, the fact that Ms. Comer's testimony was strong, part of that support comes from a letter that trial counsel wrote to his client at the conclusion of the case, explaining how he viewed the evidence. But you should consider that letter in terms of the motivations for counsel in writing that. And the letter was itself attached to an affidavit that trial counsel submitted in the post-conviction case defending against charges of ineffective assistance. So that characterization of strong really needs to be considered where
it was. But I thought it was written to explain his assessment about an appeal. That's why it was written. It may have been attached to something later, but it was not written in that context.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was written to discuss the appeal, but it was also written at the close of a trial in which this attorney had just been unsuccessful in defending the client. And so even if it was an assessment of the evidence, it is viewed through that lens. But also the idea that her testimony was strong and that was supported by the doctor. The doctor's testimony did not go unchecked. Trial counsel cross-examined him and was able to get him to discuss some different potential ways you could look at the evidence. And if she gave strong testimony, it was all the more necessary for Mr. Martin to have a trial that did not tip the scales improperly in his favor. If she's presenting a strong front, he needed to present a strong front. And because of what trial counsel did, he didn't have that. And I see that I'm almost out of time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Patrick Ebbett for the State of Oregon. The bottom line argument for the State's case in this is prejudice. But I do want to say a few words about the joinder issue first. All the charges in this case arose out of the same act of transaction.
Well, not really.
Well, I, I respectfully disagree.
They found them at the same time, but they weren't – his assault had nothing to do with guns.
It didn't, but I don't think in Oregon that's what is required. In Oregon, charges arise out of the same act of transaction if they're so closely linked in time, place, or circumstance that a complete account of one cannot be related without relating the details of the other charges.
Right, and why they just tell the whole story of the assault and stop? Why do you have to get into the gun?
Well, the phrase that I want to focus on is complete account, and that it's not just the bare elements of the offense. It's the complete narrative.
Right, it was all over, and then after that, they went off and looked in the car.
Well, I mean, I think the state doesn't have to try its case in a vacuum where we don't understand the context of why people are doing certain things. And I think in this case, witnesses...
It's possible that the assault would be relevant to the guns, but not that the guns is relevant to the assault.
Well, I think not the specific assault itself. I think you can try the case without mention of the guns, but you are leaving the jury with big blanks in the narrative of the case.
Like what?
Okay, this is a domestic violence case. One thing that's always critical in domestic violence cases is that the victim doesn't behave the way a traditional jury thinks a victim is going to be, a traditional victim of a crime is going to behave. And that's certainly true in this case. The victim calls 911 reporting that she's worried that the petitioner is going to hurt himself. It's understood from that 911 call that she's also mentioned that the reason she's concerned is because he's got guns with him. Later, after this violent assault takes place, he leaves the truck. She stays in the truck. She explains to the court why she goes into the house and follows him into the house. Something that a jury would certainly think was very odd behavior for someone who's just been victimized. But she explains why. She says, I followed him into the house because I was worried. He said he was going to commit suicide. I went into the house because I knew there were guns in the house and I was worried he was going to hurt himself. That's what she told the first officer who interviewed her. There, without that, she could testify without mention of guns, or that testimony could be submitted without.
The real issue here isn't the guns, it's the prior convictions.
Well, the petitioner's talked a lot about guns and the prejudice of the guns. And prior convictions are an issue, too. There are two ways of potential prejudice, guns and prior convictions. Both, I think, are really limited in this case. The prior conviction was for a theft. That was the predicate conviction for the felon in possession. However, in this case, defendant, when he testified, freely admitted that he had been convicted of assaulting the victim in the past. And that's why trying to explain his actions, he explained why he hid in the closet, because he knew he was on probation, and he knew he was supposed to be having contact with the victim.
You know, I'd like to ask a question about that, and deals with the staleness of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of the record that we have regarding the termination of his parole, Martin's parole? Why shouldn't we conclude, based on the record before us, that Martin's parole for his theft conviction terminated in September of 1987?
A few reasons. Procedurally, the claim was defaulted. He raised the claim before the post-conviction trial court in Oregon, and a pro se brief before the post-conviction.
Well, the question is whether the counsel was ineffective. So.
This is the post-conviction element. But you have to exhaust your. The question is whether counsel was ineffective, but you have to exhaust your ineffectiveness claim in state court first. He did not raise this claim before the Oregon Supreme Court, therefore, the claim was defaulted. On the merits.
The claim being that there shouldn't have been able to be accusation was an improper one altogether, aside from the severance.
Right. Yeah. And it was exhausted. Counsel.
Not exhausted is your claim.
I'm sorry?
I thought you were saying.
I'm sorry. It was unexhausted. Sorry. It was not exhausted. Counsel attempts to say that in her brief that it was somehow refined before the federal district court So she kind of phrased it as a refinement of the severance issue, but that's not a refinement. That's a completely different issue. And I think the district court did a good job of explaining that. In any event, on the merits, the evidence showed that his probation, that for the 15-year rule for felonies for purposes of the felon in possession of a firearm statute, the clock, the 15-year clock doesn't start ticking until the termination of one's probation. In this case, his probation wasn't terminated. The evidence of the record indicated his probation hadn't terminated until within that 15-year period. So on the merits,
we haven't talked at all about the prejudice issue.
I'm sorry?
We haven't not talked at all about the prejudice issue.
Right.
Why isn't your opponent's essential point correct? That is that there was an essential credibility issue here on a very fine-cut basis in that there was not – it's really exactly how the interaction occurred, not whether it occurred and so on. And so, therefore, the assessment of the defendant's credibility was really the whole case.
This wasn't just a he said, she said case. It was a she said plus a mountain of physical evidence plus some really compelling testimony from an ER doctor versus.
But what strikes me about it is that it was, I mean, the defendant did not deny that he hit her and he could have hurt her. There was some, but he had an explanation for why, and there was a difference as to whether she was lying down or lying up and whether he was wearing his cowboy boots. Well, he wasn't wearing his cowboy boots, but it was a difference in motivation and degree and not whether it occurred, so that the corroboration helps for sure, but it doesn't decide the whole case.
Well, he said that he was attempting to hold her, keep her from jumping out of the truck, and that was any injury must have resulted from that, and she was on her stomach, and he was trying to pin her with his boots. When the ER doctor was given a hypothetical scenario of if that would explain the injuries, he bluntly said no. He said this was the only explanation for these injuries was a brutal attack, and that was not the story that he gave in his testimony.
On her version, was he driving the whole time?
I'm sorry?
On her version, was he driving the whole time?
In her version, he was stopped. He was, I mean, one of the sort of implausible aspects.
From the truck?
I'm sorry?
When she started to get out of the truck, it was stopped?
Initially, it was, when she started to get out of the truck, it was moving, but the truck was eventually stopped when the real
But she attempted
stopping
to exit. It. She attempted to exit.
She attempted to exit when it was moving. I think she said she tried to jump out of the truck while it was moving. The truck stopped, and he proceeded to stomp on her repeatedly. His story was, and this is one of the sort of implausible things about his story, was that he testified that he held her with his right leg while he was that the truck was moving. He held her with his right leg while he had his left foot on the accelerator, a sort of gymnastic thing that really belied any sort of plausibility. One thing I just want to touch on before I end is other thing that's important to remember is the aspects of prejudice are really limited in here in this case. These were hunting rifles in a rural county, you know, in the back of a truck. These weren't assault weapons. These were not the kind of thing that would be the guns would not be explosively prejudicial. The prior conviction, as I indicated earlier, was far less prejudicial than what he admitted to in terms of his prior conviction against the victim. That is all I have, unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Hellman, you're going to get to what you're going to get to, but at a point before you sit down, you want to hit on the prejudice point if you can.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to do so. I have about 24 seconds now.
Well, we'll give you a minute and 24 seconds.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'd like to make 2 points before I turn to the prejudice very quickly. First of all, on the joinder issue, the trial court, the state trial court, specifically recognized, quote, It's significant, as I previously noted, that the firearms didn't play any direct role in the offense. Close quote. That's at my supplemental excerpt at page 1 under 28 U.S.C. 2254E. This court gives deference to that factual finding, and I think that's supported in the law as well. Two, it's absolutely correct, as Your Honor's questions have pointed out, that the core question was intent. The most esoteric and not able to physically prove question, and on that, it did matter a lot about his prejudice. In terms of the medical evidence, I'll specifically point you to excerpt of record 131, where the doctor says that there could have been an alternative explanation for the mark on her chest. She could have fallen against the stick, which I read to be perhaps the gear shift.
The evidence, though, that he had his foot under her chin is likely to come in.
That's true, Your Honor. I think all of the physical evidence is likely to come in. But again, it's if he admits
to... The fact that he also had two guns hanging in the back of the truck, in your view, turned the case rather than the brutality of the attack.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have to decide that in order to find prejudice, don't we, or do we?
Yes and no, Your Honor. I presented some alternative arguments in the briefs for why you could find prejudice merely on the fact of the convictions alone. So if you did not want to reach whether that was the turning point, you could decide it on that basis. But if you're going to reach, if you're not going to consider those and you're going to go straight to this question of whether the guns and his prior felony conviction prejudiced the case, yes, you would have to find that that's what tipped the balance. But only in terms of...
We have to, and that's one of the questions here. We would have to find that there was a reasonable probability that it could have tipped the balance. And, in fact, the district court seemed to have done it the other way.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's what I was also going to reinforce, is that the Strickland reasonable probability test is not a but-for. It's not an absolute proof. It's not even a preponderance. It's just a reasonable probability. And under the facts of this case, those things... there was a reasonable probability of this prejudice. One final very quick thing. On excerpt of record 83, Ms. Comer testifies that she did not remember whether the truck was moving or not. And so that is still, you know, a potential
issue. Finally, your argument about, just so I'm clear, and I know I'm using your time up, or our time up, your explanation of how we could decide this without getting to prejudice really is that the conviction was just wrong anyway. But that doesn't seem to be an exhaustive question. Isn't that your argument that because he really wasn't, it really was more than 15 years before and it shouldn't have been a conviction at all?
Yes, Your Honor. My position is that that is just an argument in support of the prejudice and not another claim. I understand that's at issue in this case, but yes, that's
okay.
True.
Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The case of Martin v. Mills is submitted, and we go to the last case of the day, Alexander v. Astrum.